Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking with a researcher, someone who has worked different places around the world, certainly at least in Canada and the United States, and his specialty is transportation planning and mobility. And we'll talk this morning about how it is that in an urban area, whether you're talking about a big one or a smaller one, like Champaign-Urbana, for example, how do you manage to get all of the different kinds of competing forms of transportation to work together? So people can get where they're going. People are not running each other over. People are not getting in each other's way. And particularly, can you do that by promoting alternatives to cars? Things like walking, biking, mass transit. Those are the issues that I know our guest this morning is very interested in, has talked a lot about, written about. His name is Todd Littman, and he is the founder and executive director of the Victoria Transport Policy Institute. That is an independent research organization that's interested in developing innovative solutions to transport problems. It's based in Victoria, British Columbia, in Canada. He has worked on a number of studies evaluating the cost and benefits of various transportation services and activities, and has also written or co-written a number of guides and technical manuals that have to do with transport and land use planning issues. He speaks often at conferences and workshops, and in fact is here, his visit here sponsored by the folks here at our mass transit district, and he is here to try to lend some of his expertise to the ongoing conversation about transportation issues in Champaign-Urbana. And we are pleased to have him here on the program with us, and questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. That's always the case. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana when we are where we are, is 333-9455. And we also do have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL or 9455, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David.
We appreciate it. I think that here in Champaign-Urbana, I'm sure that the issues that we have here are not very different from a lot of other places. The scale may be different, but here, and I know you're at least a little bit familiar with Champaign-Urbana, you know, here we have a relatively small area that at various times is choked by people trying to get where they're going, people walking, people on bicycles, buses, and cars. And the concern is here that it's just, we need to do something to rationalize the system a little bit better. And there are people I know here and a lot of other places who think maybe one of the ways to do that would be to see if we can get people to move away from cars to other kinds of transportation. But as we were talking about just before we got going here, the problem seems to be, the big problem seems to be that the infrastructure that we have is all geared towards the car. You know, how, when things are so set up for personal transportation in the form of the automobile, how do you even start thinking about encouraging people to use other kinds of transportation?
Yeah, that's the challenge that we face. There are a couple of ways to look at it. One is that it isn't so much forcing people to give up driving, but allowing people to give up driving when they actually would prefer to do something else. Mm-hmm. If you ask people, you know, a typical room full of residents, would you be willing to give up your car altogether? Of course, most people would say no. But if you ask people, compared with the amount of driving that you're currently doing, would you rather drive more or less? The vast majority of people I talk with say that they'd rather drive less and rely more on alternative forms of transportation, assuming that those alternatives are good quality. So that means good walking conditions, good cycling conditions, good ride-sharing options, good public transit service. And actually, there are a number of additional aspects of a multimodal transportation system. For example, if you're going to go shopping by bus or by bicycle or walking, you want to have delivery services. You want to make sure that people have good electronic communication because for a lot of people now, electronic communication can substitute for actual physical trips. These are all ways that we can create a more efficient, better, from the user's perspective, transportation system. Now, another way to look at it is to compare your community with other communities. Mm. And there are very good examples and of communities that are creating more multimodal transportation systems. And in fact, your community does well in the fact that you are a university town or a community that's built around a university. And a lot of the cities that we've seen, a lot of the smaller towns and cities that are doing really good work are college towns. And it's partly because the students themselves tend to be willing to try alternatives. There's in most college towns, you have quite high levels of walking and cycling and public transit use. But it's also because that creates a culture that accepts innovation. Mm-hmm. So now we're not talking about going from our current level of automobile use to zero automobile use. We're not talking about taking or eliminating all driving, but there are very successful programs that shift 10, 20, 30% of trips that are made by driving. So, for example, a typical commuter might be using public transit or a van pooling 2 days a week. And if you can do that, you've pretty much eliminated most of your transportation problems.
Yeah. It seems to me that part of the problem might be that essentially the going back to this infrastructure idea, the infrastructure that all these forms of transportation use, if you include the sidewalk, which is sort of contiguous with the road, here is that we have different forms of transportation all trying to use the same system in a sense, trying to use the same infrastructure. Is it possible for that really to work, or is part of the deal that you have to find some way to separate them enough so that everybody's not trying to use the same road, the same street, the same walkway, and that's part of the problem?
Well, there are a number of details to making sure that a community is multimodal, mm-hmm. and that's what we're talking about. And part of that is what we call complete streets. A complete street means that the street is designed to accommodate all the forms of transportation. For most of the last half century, most transportation engineering has been very automobile oriented. And so you've got streets, and particularly the arterials, the urban highways, streets that are designed really primarily for automobile transportation. They're designed to maximize vehicle traffic flow. And in fact, the units, the ways that transportation engineers measure roadway quality is almost entirely from a motorist perspective. So they use concepts called level of service ratings and average traffic speeds and things like that. And these only measure the quality of the road system from the motorist perspective. And so that's been built into the planning process to favor design features that encourage automobile travel. They increase traffic volumes and speeds. Well, it turns out that especially for pedestrian travel, a high-speed, wide road is not a very conducive environment. That isn't to say that you need to that every street should be greatly reduced. That you can't have any streets over 20 miles an hour. I mean, you are going to have, say, 40 mile an hour streets in urban areas, but there are a number of design details that we can use to greatly improve the quality of transportation for people who are using other forms of transportation. So part of it is good sidewalks. And transportation engineers, they use the concept of a design vehicle. They say, okay, we got to design this road or this parking lot to accommodate this type of vehicle. And basically, they have in mind the biggest vehicle that they're going to need, a truck, say a garbage truck or a fire truck. Mm-hmm. Okay, what's the design vehicle for the pedestrian environment? Well, it should be a little old lady in a walker, using a walker, and her boyfriend who's in a wheelchair. In other words, we should make the pedestrian environment so such good quality that even people with disabilities can use it and walk side by side. Now, there's nothing radical about that, and yet our current transportation planning simply doesn't recognize it. As long as we have planning processes and funding accounts that are basically dedicated to improving the roadway from a motorist perspective, you won't have the resources going to improve the environment, the street environment for walkers and bicyclists and transit users. Keep in mind, every transit trip, virtually every transit trip is also a walking trip. And so part of what makes transit work, makes transit attractive, is to make sure that it's good to walk where you get. Okay, so there are some very well understood, clear ways that we can make our streets better for all these different modes and safer. But it goes beyond that, because it isn't just the design of the streets, it's actually the design of the community. For example, if you live out in one of the really new suburban communities, most of those are designed without any services. That is, no stores, no medical clinics, and often no elementary schools anywhere within walking distance. And the streets are actually designed, again, from a motorist perspective, they're not designed for walking. A lot of them don't have sidewalks. They're not well connected, so you have a lot of dead-end streets. And all of that results in, even if you had sidewalks in those neighborhoods, you still wouldn't walk very much because you don't have what's called mixed land use. So part of creating a more multimodal transportation system, it isn't just the design of the streets. That's an important component, but it's not the end of it. It's also how you use land use to make a multimodal community. For example, when you want to get the latest video, do you hop in your car and drive to a video store, or do you walk to a store?
No, I got to get in the car and drive there.
Okay, so you live in a more automobile-oriented location.
Mm.
Okay. Would you be better off if you had a video store within, say, a quarter mile of your home?
Oh, absolutely. Well, if somebody knew where I lived and knew where the closest video store that was, they might say, Dave, you actually could walk there.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, I actually walk back and forth between my house and here,
yeah,
where we are now. So it's interesting that here we have a place where it's actually possible.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people do, and a lot of people use bikes. But it's easy to go the default route and say, well, wouldn't it just be easier to get in the car and do that?
Okay, now here's the positive message that I have for you.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the incentive for you to leave that car at home and walk when you have to get a video. And that is, the Surgeon General recommends that people get 30 minutes of moderate exercise every day to stay healthy. Now, in the past, we've thought of walking as something undesirable, and we don't want to do it, and we want to design it out of our lives, and we want to design parking facilities so they're right at the front door of every building. We want to locate schools where they're easy to drive to, despite the fact that that means that they're difficult to walk to. We want to locate our businesses at the suburban edge where they're easy to drive to, but we're not, you know, creating communities where people can walk. And as a result, the United States and other developed countries are seeing very severe problems with people simply not getting enough basic exercise. That's a sedentary lifestyle. So how can you and how can you, all your neighbors, build in that 30 minutes of exercise a day? Do you think people will go to a gym and work out 30 minutes a day every day for the rest of their lives?
No.
Okay. Do you think
no.
We can build a more walkable community where it becomes normal for people when they have to go, when they want to go for an errand, when their children are going to school or visiting friends, that they walk? Mm-hmm. Is that possible?
Well, that would be, I'd say that would be a nice goal.
Sure.
Maybe it even is possible. Well, but I guess what I would say, though, and I expect what a lot of people would say, is if you're going to build the community from the ground up, you could, and there are places where people are experimenting with that kind of community design, you can design a community that works that way. What do you do if you have an existing community where the infrastructure, the roads, the sidewalks, the businesses, the housing is already what it is, and you have to deal with what you've got? I mean, now if we decided that we wanted to make it possible for everybody to walk to the video rental store in Champaign-Urbana, we'd have to have an awful lot of video rental stores.
Well, you're absolutely right. It's much easier if you essentially play God. You're creating this utopian community from scratch. And I actually find that rather boring. It's much more challenging but much more interesting to take an existing community and think about how we can make this better than to start from scratch. And actually, most of the experiments where somebody has designed a community from scratch have turned out to be almost utter failures for various reasons, partly because none of us are smart enough to get all of the details right. It really is a communal experience to get these things right. So, for example, Brasilia, in the capital, the new capital of Brazil, and other cities that were created from the ground up with some kind of a grand vision, and they usually brought in some world-famous designer, they actually turn out to be lousy at first, and then they have to change organically over time. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're absolutely right. It is more challenging. On the other hand, your community, this city, these cities are actually very good in their basic structure because they were built. The basic street system in these areas were built in the days where walking and cycling and public transit use were very common. And so you have a grid street system, you have a downtown, you have sidewalks on most streets. You have the features that used to be unquestionable. There was no doubt when you were building a city in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, when you were building a new community, that you would make it walkable. And you would have corner stores. It was very common for every few blocks there to be a little corner store. And you'd have delivery services. And you'd have all the other things that make it possible to lead a multimodal life, to use alternative forms of transportation on a day-to-day basis. Okay. Since about 1970, the new development has not had those features. But that's actually a minor portion of your total landscape here in this community. And so you're actually doing quite well. Hmm. Now, it does take what we call road diets on the arterials. That means that there's a lot of interest in redesigning these automobile-oriented strip arterials into much more pedestrian-friendly, multimodal roads, and we call that a road diet. And it's been very successful in plenty of communities. We know exactly how to do it. It increases property values. It solves a number of problems. You can do it very nicely in downtown areas or at the suburban edge where you have this kind of existing sprawl. Part of what you're doing is you're incorporating more mixed land use. So one of the things you try and do is locate more housing in what was previously a commercial-only area. So, for example, you could take a big shopping mall. Often there were shopping malls that were built in the 1960s and 70s that are now past their prime. And the question is, what do you do with a big old shopping mall, lots of parking? Well, one of the things you do is you start building housing right around there. You put in your senior housing. You put in some student housing. You put in just nice new condominiums and townhouses right around there. And that becomes, you change from it being just a shopping center to a multi-use urban village. And that's where, for example, when your family decides to downsize from a house to an apartment or to a townhouse, you choose to locate there because that's within walking distance, convenient walking distance of the services that you want. And that makes a lot of sense to do that kind of redevelopment in the places, what you can call brownfields or dilapidated areas, the places that are now a problem, you turn that problem into an opportunity.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Todd Littman. He is the founder and executive director of the Victoria Transport Policy Institute in Victoria, British Columbia, in Canada. It's a research organization that's interested in developing solutions to transport problems. And he is here visiting in Champaign-Urbana to provide some advice to folks here who are thinking about these very issues. And questions are welcome. In fact, we have a couple of people here ready to go. Questions are welcome here on the show. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And we have someone listening this morning in Indiana, so they are first. Line number four. Hello.
Hello. This is another one of them 1,000 different subs that can all come up at once kind of programs. To me, this is a commentary. It's sort of like rationality versus aesthetics, and I'd illustrate that by your two examples about making sure the streets accommodate concrete spreader or asphalt spreader or whatever kind of spreader you want, and the second one about the elderly couple wanting to go down the sidewalk, which one is in a wheelchair. Those kinds of things operate even at the small town level, and most of your illustrations are, you're talking, large scale. You talk about student housing, senior citizen housing, things like that. The community I live in now, the student housing would have to be like for high school students or grade school students. So I'd like for you to see if the blanket covers the small towns, which are even in less situation to have power to say what happens when a planner comes in and is hooked up with the business community and they do things. And I remember from the late 40s, things were done for World War II vets that must have upset a lot of people who want to save money. But they were nice communities, and I lived on the edge of one for a while. And if you could, what about World War II? Did it set the golden standards? Have we swerved from there, or are we still doing the one blanket takes care of everything idea? Thanks.
Well, can you respond to that?
The great thing about being a planner is you have to recognize that every community has its own needs and preferences. And so you're absolutely right. One blanket solution does not apply everywhere. But what I can say is that the economic and demographic trends are in favor of more multimodal transportation, and this applies to small rural communities and medium-sized cities and big cities altogether. Let me just mention a couple of them. One is that the population in North America is aging. So the portion of people in, say, the over 70 age group is going to significantly increase in the next few years, and you're seeing more and more of those people are preferring to live in a community that meets their needs where they don't have to drive a lot, and that when it comes time for them to give up their driving, that's not a big problem. So if you anticipate the aging baby booming population, one of the things you would do is make sure that at least every community, including rural communities, have some urban villages that are just the sensible place for a family that's downsizing to be able to stay in their community, but have those design features, that walkability and the ability to get by without driving, that's all located in one area. So maybe your rural community or your small town needs to start thinking about the aging baby boomers. Another issue is that the price of fuel is going to go up. And there are a number of reasons for that, and it's probably not going to get as high as what some people claim, that, it's going to be totally unaffordable. No, it'll just be more expensive. But one of the implications of rising fuel prices is that a lot of people, including working class people and young families in particular, and seniors, people on a fixed income, are going to see a greater value in having transportation options so they don't have to drive as much. Again, they might still own a car and they might do some driving, but they will. But you will find more middle-class people who own a car will be amenable to leave their car at home and vanpool or ride public transit or carpool if those services are available in order to save money on fuel. So those are just a couple of examples of reasons that your community, regardless of whether it's urban or rural, might want to start thinking about creating a more multimodal transportation system.
I've got some other people here, and I want to get right to it. I promise I won't make them wait too long. But I guess in my mind, I do keep coming back to the question that I think also was implicit in what Carling had to say, and that is, for this kind of approach to transportation to work, don't you have to have a certain population density? That is, you've got to have enough people together in a small enough area so that that will then support, you will have enough people to support the services that those people need. I mean, it seems to me that we have this sort of a proverbial chicken-egg sort of deal here that says people need the services, but the services won't be there unless you have the people, and that I'm not sure, you know, how you do that when you get below a certain population density.
Sure. Well, in a truly, totally rural area, you don't have these kind of transportation problems.
Right.
I mean, basically, the main transportation problem in a truly rural area is simply accommodating cars, and to a small degree, a little bit of walking and cycling. But if the traffic volumes are really low, then you can walk on the road. And the main question is, you know, yes or no, should you pave the roadways? You know, is the roadway paved and is it passable during bad weather? Okay, so in a truly rural area, that's the main concern. That and making sure that rural residents can get where they need to go when they can't drive, either when they have a physical disability or low income or whatever. So there are some rural transportation issues, but they're mainly concerned with increasing automobile, being able to accommodate even more automobile travel, or providing very specialized services, for example, what we call demand response, a special van that will take people with disabilities to a few medical, you know, to things like medical appointments. But the main transportation problems that we're seeing in most communities are things like traffic congestion, parking congestion, parents who are tired of chauffeuring children all over the place, things like that. Those tend to be the traditional very small town, the traditional rural community that has a town with a couple hundred residents. That is essentially the ideal. You've got enough people living together that you can support a couple stores and hopefully a medical clinic, and everything's within walking distance. And that actually, you know, the kind of problems that we're talking about here in this city and in most other cities, is solved to some degree when you have these cohesive urban villages. So there are certainly a lot of things we can do in rural areas to improve transportation and solve problems. And I can talk, you know, we could talk about exactly how to do that, but that isn't the problem in Champaign Urbana, and it isn't the problem that seems to be the most intense in most communities. So again, I want to say that the problems and solutions are unique in every community, and we need and planning is all about matching, you know, identifying those problems and finding solutions, and so we have to go from community to community. But it makes sense to start thinking about the kind of strategies I'm talking about. In almost every community, whether it's rural and we're talking about creating alternatives when the price of fuel makes it too expensive for rural residents to drive as much, and in cities where it's about reducing traffic congestion and air pollution.
All right. Well, let's talk with some other folks here. We have someone in the community of Eureka here next, line number one.
Thank you. You're very on target. My mind is so filled, I hardly know where to begin, but I think there are two specific areas, or three, that I'd just like to comment and get your reaction. I think, number one, your idea about walking seems excellent. It just seems like people want to think they have to go to the Cadillac when they need sort of a middle ground, and walking, swimming, and cycling are probably the best you can do and in terms of the most practical you can do throughout most of your life. secondly, I think we have problems that result from our lack of community, and maybe that's one of the reasons why we have such a high violence rate, and we just don't seem to have the sense of community. And I think the car and the individual driver are partly responsible. But thirdly, I guess my biggest point is I think we can do something, and I think you were alluding to it before, like walking simply, practically, and that is just getting to the idea of preaching conservation. And I realize one size doesn't fit all. Eureka is different than Urbana, but all sorts of things can be employed, all the way from bike paths to vans to buses. But I think the main thing is, and it's not going to be accomplished overnight, but even a 20% or 30% drop in people using cars would produce some very great benefits. And again, I think we don't have to think extraordinarily or billions of it, but just very practical, down-to-earth things.
Yeah, thank you. It's always nice to get positive feedback. I agree with everything that you say, but I want to add one little detail, and that is I think we want to do more than simply appeal to people's good intention.
Mm-hmm.
And my specialty, one of the things that I have done a lot of research on, is looking at what incentives can get people to change help people change their travel behavior that are not simply saying, oh, do this because it's good for the environment, or do this because it's good for your community.
Can I interrupt? It's economic that's the most powerful, right?
Absolutely. And let me give you just one example. Right now, a lot of employees get a free parking space at their work site.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a typical parking space, particularly in an urban area, has a value of $500 to $1,000 a year. That's what the employer is paying to provide that parking space. Now, it's simply fair that if you don't drive, that is, if you ride public transit or vanpool or bicycle or walk, you should be getting a similar benefit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's a concept
mm-hmm.
called parking cash out, and all it says is that if an employer offers their employees a free parking space, the employee should also have the option of being able to say, no, I want the cash instead. Okay, when you do that, typically something like 20% of commute trips shift. That is, when you have a level playing field. So instead of only being offered $1,000 a month worth of parking and no alternative, if you use another form of transportation, if we simply level it and we say, okay, you either get the $1,000 a month worth of parking, or you get the $1,000 a month or $1,000 a year worth of parking, or $1,000 a year worth of cash, you see a significant reduction in car trips. Or to put it differently, about 20% of our peak period traffic. And so 20% of traffic congestion problems and parking mm-hmm. problems and accidents associated with that travel is the result from a bias in the way we employers offer their employees benefits that favors automobile commuting mm-hmm. at the expense of other modes. So
go ahead.
Well, so those are the kind of strategies that I think should be considered beyond simply appealing to people's good intentions.
You could use higher gas taxes. That would do it. And I think high schools are notorious for having so many people that don't need to drive. And I think that would cut down on how many problems in schools are related to people driving. Yeah, you could use the market creatively, too.
There are many, many ways that we can do it that actually make everybody better off.
Could I ask one more question?
Yeah, sure.
Are you at the University of British Columbia in Victoria?
There's a University of Victoria in Victoria.
Oh,
the University of British Columbia is in Vancouver.
Yeah, that's right. I lived up island around Courtney many years ago. I loved it. It's the most beautiful place in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Vancouver Island. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let me again reintroduce our guest. We're heading to about our last 15 minutes. We're talking here this morning with Todd Littman. He is an internationally known researcher who specializes in transportation planning and mobility. He's the founder, executive director of the Victoria Transport Policy Institute. This is an independent research organization interested in developing innovative solutions to transport problems, and it is based in Victoria, British Columbia, in Canada. He's done a lot of studies evaluating the costs and benefits of various transportation services. He's written or co-written a number of guides and technical manuals dealing with transport and land use planning issues, and does a lot of speaking at conferences and workshops. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Fine. And we'll go on here. We have someone in Savoy there next, line number two. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Yeah.
You know, we've had a you know, we've had quite a controversy here in Champaign-Urbana with the MTD expanding and everything. And I went and I took a look at their budget. I went and I looked at it several different ways. I went and I took their capital budget, their operating budget, and their revenue, and then divided it roughly by their stated ridership. You know, and it came up to about $1,000 a trip. And, you know, what's an upper economic limit to sustain one of these systems whenever you're talking about that kind of money?
I'd have to see your figures. I'm skeptical that it's $100 a trip.
Well, that's more than $100.
I think the caller said $1,000 a trip.
It's $100 a trip.
What is typical, it may be per year worth of trip, year worth of trips.
Yeah, if you take their capital budget, you have to, their budget is more than just fuel, salary, and maintenance. You have to go and look at how much they're spending in capital, which is, you know, depreciation. And whenever you go and you add capital, you go and you add all the other expenses, and then you tack on the revenue that they take in, and then divide it by the ridership, it's several hundred dollars per trip.
I'm pretty skeptical of that. Now, typically, in most communities, it costs between $1 and about $5 per trip.
Oh, it's a lot more here.
Well, anyway, let me tell you what I know about the economics of transportation, and that is, you're absolutely right that public transit, conventional public transit that we know, does receive what seems like a generous subsidy from the taxpayers.
Yeah, on my tax bill, it's about $200 a year.
Well, I'm very skeptical that it is $1,000 or even hundreds of dollars per trip.
It's several hundred dollars a trip.
Well,
yeah.
If so, your community is totally off the scale compared with every other community that I've looked at. But regardless, here's the point, is that what do you think it costs society in terms of total costs for an automobile trip on the same corridor?
Well, if you go and you take, the capital cost of a car is, let's say it's $20,000 new, and the average lifetime of a car, let's say it's 150,000 miles.
Well, let's just say that the typical person spends about $5,000 a year on a car, and then you got to provide several parking spaces for that car, right? One at your home, one at your work site, one at the various stores that you visit. And then somebody's got to provide roads for that car to drive on. So what do you think it costs society for a typical automobile trip?
Well, it's difficult to say. It's less than a couple hundred dollars a trip.
You're right.
I can tell you that.
It works out to be $5 to $10 a trip when you take into account all costs. So I'm pretty sure that you're wrong, and that if you do the analysis, that your transit system is probably spending comparable to the total cost of a car trip, or even less. But here's the kicker, is the cost per trip of public transit is relatively high in North America because of the low ridership rates.
Oh, yeah. Around here, I mean, the only places you ever see people on these buses is on campus, and I bet you could go down there today and, you know, those buses might have, at the most, maybe a dozen people on them.
Right.
I think they seat, I don't know, 75 people or so, maybe more.
Well, and so it's the best way that you can increase the efficiency, the cost efficiency of your system, is to give more people an incentive to actually ride the transit system, right? Now, I'm not in favor of running transit systems if they're not being used.
Yeah. Well,
the key point being that part of running a good transit or good multimodal transportation system, it isn't just running buses. It's running buses and having these reforms that give people an incentive to actually use public transit and vanpooling and walking and bicycling. So if you implement things like parking cash out and you work with employers to create a more level playing field, and you do public or walking improvements, and you improve the quality of service, things like HOV lanes and transit priority lanes. We have seen that a lot of communities have significantly reduced the per-trip cost of providing public transit, and I can name you cities that have gotten it down to well below the average, so maybe $1 or $2 per trip, and it's because they're using an integrated program like this, and it makes everybody better off.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're a long ways from it, and, you know, and that district's really... It's a long ways from being a service to this community at this point, except down on campus. And
well, let
we
me
have
ask
a real
you this.
Problem on campus.
Have you ever lived for a while without owning a car?
Yeah, I did in Germany, yeah.
Okay. So
I still needed a car.
Right. At some point in your life, you're going to have to give up driving, right?
Yeah, eventually you're going to grow old.
Do you think that your attitude about the transit system and the value of having the public transit service will shift when you are no longer able to drive?
I'm not advocating junking it. I'm just advocating that, you know, people got to get real with the budget on that thing.
Well, I'm quite certain that you're wrong with your budget estimates, and so we'd have to look at the numbers.
I'm adding in the capital expenses.
Right, but even so, since you're only operating buses, the capital is fairly low, and I can tell you from all kinds of transit systems throughout the world that I've studied, that the costs that you're citing are orders of magnitude higher than what any other system. But if you do want to see a very successful system, I suggest going down to Boulder, Colorado. That's a good example of a city that has done a terrific job offering quality service at a very affordable price.
I'm going to jump in here, up the call, forgive me, but we just have about 5 minutes left, and I have a couple of other callers I want to try to include. Going next to somebody in Champaign, and this is line 4, I believe. Hello.
Hello, this is Bruce. I was the... I had a couple of things. I think what you're talking about is very laudable, but I think it ignores two mega drivers that have been driving the economy for decades now. One of those is the trend toward economies of scale in all kinds of things, and also globalization. You could talk about this as being perhaps, you know, the Walmarting of society, although you could put Target in there and a bunch of other places. Also, the consolidation and enlargement of our manufacturing and distribution facilities, where they're located, tremendous amount of traffic that goes just to keep our economy running, that moves along the highways and streets, concerning just the distribution. That you were on either of the coasts and you just took a look at some of the ports. And the amount of freight that's coming in from everywhere, most of it really probably now from China and the Far East.
Sure.
We've got things here which I think really make a problem. Your problem's not just cars; it's these other things which tend to exacerbate problems of getting away from an automobile.
Well, it works both ways. So there are a number of trends that. You're right that there are some trends that increase vehicle traffic, but there are a lot of trends that go the other way. And from what you're in terms of freight, about 5% of total vehicle miles are driven by trucks, by freight trucks. And they do get to concentrate on certain corridors. So certain highways have high rates of freight. But here's the key is that it to the degree that you're right, and I agree with you, these are there is increased truck traffic. To the degree that that is particularly important for our economy, the more that we can get motorists, people that are taking personal trips, to use more efficient forms of transportation, that's freeing up road space for those high-value, larger vehicles. So nothing that I'm saying here is contradicted by the fact that there is increasing demand, increasing traffic volumes by large trucks. In fact, the best thing that you can do to improve the efficiency of the freight distribution system, the truckers, is to reduce peak period automobile traffic.
Yeah, I understand that, but you know, for example, let's talk about another thing on this globalization, the economies of scale that that affect people in cities. For example, let's say that you have a factory that shuts down here in Champaign, and people looking for jobs can't find them here. They find one, say, in Bloomington or Danville or Decatur or some other location around, and that's where they can do it. They may not necessarily move, but they tend to will commute for quite a while. Because
sure, and that's another example of where having good travel options. So, for example, knowing that if you have to commute 60 or 80 miles, that there'll be a vanpool service available, that somebody is thinking about that and saying, okay, we had 500 employees who just got laid off, and some of them are going to take jobs in the next town over, and so we're going to have dozens of people who are currently living in this community who are going to be commuting 60 miles or 80 miles. Let's provide vanpool service, or maybe if there are enough of them, let's provide some express bus service. So what you're talking about is actually a justification or a reinforcement of what I'm talking about, the value of having good travel options and having a good planning system so somebody is thinking about providing these kind of services.
Yeah. I think there's another aspect here. I mean, in terms of having, you know, stores like we had, say, when I was growing up, where you'd have a, you know, a five and dime, and, you know, you'd have a local drugstore, and you'd have all those things within walking distance. You know, today there are much fewer stores. They tend to be out in the mall someplace. And let's say you lived in Southwest Champaign, and you're a number of miles away from, say, the mall or a place where you can actually do the shopping, and you've got a choice between taking a public transportation bus, where I have to leave 2 hours early so that I can get there, and then I've got a problem. What do I do when I've got this stuff? How do I get it back home?
And, right, I agree. And, not every trip.
You know, this is it's a real problem when I can drive there in 15 minutes,
right,
do what I'm trying to do, and then come back, and I don't have to worry about waiting for public transportation to accommodate.
You're absolutely right. Not every trip is suitable for shifting from automobile to public transit. So the trips you're describing might be the ones that stay as driving. But you would be better off, if you're that in that situation, you're far better off if you live in a, if your planners encourage more stores to be located closer to you, so that you, whether you're driving or walking or bicycling or using public transit, the trip is shorter. And there are a number of planning strategies that can create that more multimodal transportation system.
Yeah, I want to thank the caller again and see if I can squeeze one more person here. It's a caller on Kankakee, line 3. Hello.
Champaign is part of a Chicago, University Park, Illinois, Kankakee, Carbondale, Memphis, New Orleans education corridor, served by the Illinois Central Railroad and Interstates 55 and 57. Would you please talk about high-speed rail and the interface between education and passenger railway service and how it might be enhanced? Thank you.
Sure, although I'm not sure I'll satisfy you. I am actually, I don't advocate any particular technology. What I advocate is a good comprehensive planning system that looks at the benefits and costs of each option and critically evaluates what's the best way to improve our transportation system. And I have no idea whether this corridor is one that makes, where high-speed rail makes sense. And what I would say is that even if you implement high-speed rail, sometimes a technology like that is presented as the solution to our transportation problems. Actually, that would probably accommodate maybe 1 or 2% of the trips, maybe 10% or 20% of the trips on that corridor. But there are all kinds of reasons that people can't simply shift. So I think what we need to do is think in terms of a comprehensive system. Now, if one portion of that system is a high-speed rail and that turns out to be cost-effective, great. But it may be that you're better off simply offering very, very good bus service or increasing the frequency of conventional train service on that corridor or organizing more van pools. In other words, there's a whole continuum of solutions that are out there, and you have to look critically at each of the options and create a system based on those, that wide range. And so I have no idea, I cannot say whether high-speed rail makes sense on that corridor, but I would say that regardless of what you do with high-speed rail, you still, regardless of what whether you build this major new component, you should be doing everything you can to creating to create a more diversified, balanced transportation system.
Yeah. It's extraordinarily complicated, really, because there are a lot of different questions here. We're talking about different levels, and if you talk about something as big as, you know, if you set your frame really wide, then you really are having to talk about everything from how do you get somebody from here to Chicago, but also how do you get somebody from one side of Champaign-Urbana to the other. It's a really different set of issues. They interlock maybe, but they're distinct issues, and there's probably not one solution that's going to solve all your problems.
That's what makes transportation planning so fun.
Well, at that, we're going to have to finish up with our thanks to our guest, Todd Littman. He is the founder and executive director of the Victoria Transport Policy Institute. It is an independent research organization. They're based in Victoria, British Columbia, in Canada. They're interested in working on developing innovative solutions to transport problems. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much, David.